You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
Hello and welcome to History Hack. I am flying solo today, it's Merrin, and with me I have Sophie Ambler. Now I'm going to introduce Sophie. Sophie is a historian with interests wide ranging across medieval Christendom. She's reader in late medieval history at Lancaster University, deputy director of the Centre for War and Diplomacy at Lancaster, and she is author of The Song of Simon de Montfort, England's First Revolutionary. Welcome to History Hack, Sophie.
Hi, Merrin. Thanks very much for having me.
Good to see you. Now then, Simon de Montfort. I'm going to wade in here and say that my knowledge of Simon de Montfort, you could probably write on the back of a postage stamp, but it is a name, one of those names that kind of seeps into your mind, particularly, I think, if... I had a quick look at the curriculum, and it's one of those names that sort of pops up, gets glossed over, but there's definitely more to him than meets the eye, isn't there? Mm-hmm. So shall we start? Would you like to tell us what everybody needs to know? If this was the only thing they needed about Simon de Montfort, what do they need to know? Who was he?
Well, the Simon de Montfort who appears on the curriculum is Simon de Montfort, who was Earl of Leicester in 13th century England. Now, actually, there are two very famous Simon de Montfort. The first one is the Earl of Leicester, who I mentioned. The other is his father, also called Simon, who led the Albigensian Crusade in the early 13th century in the south of France against the so-called Cathar heretics. So if people have heard of Simon de Montfort, they're usually thinking of either one or the other, but they tend to think of them entirely separately.
Okay, so this is a bit confusing between the Simons.
Yes, so the Montfort family love their family names. So they're all either called Simon or Amory or Guy. So there's a complex numbering system and historians disagree about the numbers. So it gets very, very confusing. And we just have to find sort of different ways of categorising them. So the one who I'm particularly interested in is Simon de Montfort, Earl of Leicester, who was the son of the leader of the Albigensian Crusade. And Simon Earl of Leicester is famous for a couple of reasons, and that is particularly leading a revolution against King Henry III of England in the 1250s and 1260s. King Henry was the son of King John, nasty old King John. King Henry, nothing like his father, but he was a very pious and very pious king at the time. He rebuilt Westminster Abbey, but there was a lot of discontent with his government. Simon de Montfort led a movement to oust him from power and set up a council to govern in the king's name. He turned this movement into a civil war in the 1260s, won a famous victory against the king at the Battle of Lewes in 1264, took the king captive, set up a whole new constitution for the government of England, where the king was just somewhere off on the sideline. And this lasted until the summer of 1265, when he was cut down with most of his followers at the Battle of Evesham, and the monarchy was restored to power. And during this time, he also held a very famous parliament in the early months of 1265 that's sometimes called the First House of Commons, because it was the first time that representatives from the towns, as well as knights from the shires, was summoned to Parliament for the first time. So it's really a sort of a landmark event in those terms. So he's often remembered by people interested in the history of Parliament, sort of parliamentary history circles and so on.
So he's a really influential figure on our history, isn't he? Perhaps we should just start then by having a look at some of the influences on his life. You talk early on in your book about Simon's father, also called Simon. Can you give us a sense of Simon's upbringing and what created this, what feels like already a strong and bold character?
Well, I said that there are two famous Simon de Montfort, the father, Albigensian Simon, and the son, let's call him Parliamentary Simon. Okay. And people tend to think of them separately. Albigensian Simon de Montfort is not a very popular character at all, because he's known as this sort of monster who came into the south of France and persecuted people of the region who dissented from the Catholic faith. Now, that just doesn't make sense in the context of the time, in the sense that the whole family was bound together in this common enterprise. And Simon, Earl of Leicester, as he grew up in England and as he pursued his career, was incredibly influenced by the memory of his father and very much sought to follow in his footsteps. So really, we have to look at them both together and understand the role that Albigensian Simon and his memory played in 13th century England, but also particularly the ideals of crusading, because the Albigensian Crusade was a holy war, as it was deemed at the time, against so-called heretics, dissenters, and this was absolutely integral in this period to sort of the ethos of what it meant to be a knight and a leader. And Albigensian Simon, the father, really embodied so much of what was seen as the ideal of knighthood in this period. So that's why he was so influential. Simon, Earl of Leicester, was a baby, really, when his father was elected leader of the Albigensian Crusade. And he spent the first 10 years or so of his life growing up on this crusade in the south of France with his siblings, with his mother and with his father, who were all there together. So this is really where he was brought up, in a war zone, in the Albigensian Crusade, looking up to his father and his older brothers and his mother.
Going into the family trade, as it were, which was crusading.
Very much so, very much so. And what's particularly important with the Montfort is that crusading very much becomes a family trade. But in particular, it's not enough now for the Montfort men just to go on crusade. They have to be leading it. They have to be leading the expedition. And this is what Simon the Elder does in the south of France. He leads the Albigensian Crusade. There's a very famous chronicle written about him describing his great deeds during the Albigensian Crusade and setting him up as the great leader of the expedition, picking out all of the admirable traits that he embodied as leader, sticking true to his oath to go on to crusade, no matter the cost, no matter the personal cost, his personal courage and his leadership. And this chronicle really was what Simon, his son, was really brought up with. It's almost like a training manual for how to be a knight and how to lead. So it's really, this is the model that is set up for the Earl of Leicester. It's leading an expedition.
So there's, I mean, I'm almost tempted to say there's an element of family pride in following the family trade going, you know, and leading, not just taking part, but leading. But I'm guessing there were also other influences, societal, political influences. Can you tell us a little bit about the political infrastructure they would have been living in, the kind of place and what would have been happening to their family then?
Mm. Sure. So Simon de Montfort, Earl of Leicester, he it's important to note that he ends up being Earl of Leicester, even though his family really was hailed from northern France, because of a family claim to the Earldom of Leicester. So Simon, being a younger son, after his father died in 1218, came to England and approached King Henry III and asked for his claim to Leicester to be recognised, really sort of seeking his fortune, as it were. The claim was acknowledged, so he set up in England. So we're talking about, you know, what was the kind of the shape of the political community in England in the first half of the 13th century. And this is a very interesting time, actually, because it follows in the wake of the first issue of Magna Carta in the reign of King John, when really the kingdom in the early 13th century had been riven by civil war under King John, with a great deal of discontent against his government. Magna Carta had been issued for the first time in 1215 that really set kingship within the law codified that concept very much and embedded it into political society.
And did that seep down into general society quite quickly, that idea of the change of way of living?
It's quite hard to tell, but I think so. And increasingly as the 13th century went on, so Magna Carta was annulled a few weeks after its first issue in 1215, but there were new versions in 1216, 1217, and the definitive issue in 1225. And what's particularly important about the 1225 definitive issue of Magna Carta is that it is enforced by the church, by a sentence of excommunication, so that anyone who breaks Magna Carta, whether that be the king or the lowest person in society, is automatically cast out from the community of the faithful. And that has serious implications. But what it also means is that the church publicizes Magna Carta extensively across the kingdom to make sure that everybody knows what's in it, because you don't want to break it accidentally and then find your soul in jeopardy. So Magna Carta is read out in parish churches and public meeting places. So from, you know, the greatest of the great to the lowest of the low, if we can put it like that, in society, people probably have a pretty good idea of what's in Magna Carta. And that's everything from the big clauses, such as the king shall not deprive anybody of their property or execute them or put them in prison or seize their land without judgment by peers or the law of the land, to all of those much smaller clauses about feudal rights and so on.
So this is important, because if so much effort has gone into Magna Carta, actually the powers that be, whether they be ecclesiastical, whether they be political, they actually want to make it work now, don't they? So the king has a vested interest, even if he's not completely on board with what he's agreed to, he has a vested interest in making sure that, one, that everybody understands what's about to happen, and two, that actually he's in a good place to ensure Magna Carta is enforced. So who's taking advice from on this?
Well, this is a really important question. So one of the big issues in politics in the Middle Ages is, who is the king taking advice from? Because obviously whoever is giving him advice is in a really influential position to affect policy and patronage particularly. So King John had been well known or notorious actually for taking advice only from a very small sort of group of cronies. Henry III just couldn't do that. Now that's partly because one of the important principles that had really been established in and around the Magna Carta Civil War was that a king can't go forward with taxation without general consent. And consent, you get consent by a national assembly, as it were, the great and the good, bishops and abbots and earls and barons gathering together to decide whether or not a tax can be allowed. And that means usually the king has to provide a reason why he needs it, and then there's discussion and debate. And that's how Magna Carta's definitive issue comes about in 1225. It's granted in return for a tax agreed in a national assembly, which in the 1230s comes to be known as Parliament for the first time. So for those really big policies, such as national taxation, you've got a Parliament which is effectively giving advice or consent. And then you've also got a working council of bishops and barons and officers who might have to swear an oath to serve the king well and to give him good counsel. But then you get something much more informal, which is the men standing around at court who are in and around the king, who have the ability to whisper in his ear, to gain influence more informally. And that's particularly potentially controversial, because it's very difficult for people to see what's going on, to check that all is above board, and also it gives potentially unscrupulous people influence. So this is always, I think in any political community in the Middle Ages, it's a matter for debate, but this is one of the potential issues in Henry III's reign. Simon de Montfort is one of those councillors in and around the king, as are several others.
So So what we've got then is an emerging sense of, and I hesitate to use the word because I know that there are people wiser than I who would assign the word to a particular area, but there's an emerging sense of democratic order. And certainly parliament meaning the meeting place, this idea of consensual taxation through representation, it infers almost that we're coming to a better form of structure for the people and the people, you know, being governed. But was it a stable period? We've had some unrest. Was it stable? Is Simon advising in a stable period, or are we looking at a period of still of turmoil and dissent?
Structure is a really good way of putting it, because this is exactly what people want. They want something a bit more formal and structured to see those checks and balances in place. In terms of whether this sort of period was stable or not, the answer is a bit of yes and a bit of no. Typical sort of historian's answer.
The answer is yes until I contradict myself. Yes, no problem.
Exactly. So it's stable in a sense that we've got to put this in the broader perspective and say, look, Henry III had a very long reign. He was no King John. That is, he wasn't deliberately or kind of provocatively setting out to rile people. He also managed, by the end of his reign in the 1270s, at his death, to see the transfer of power peacefully over to his son, Edward I. So we've got to point out all of this and say, look, in the sort of grand context, you could say it was relatively stable. You can also point to the development of those structures, particularly Parliament. And the 13th century is really critical in the establishment of Parliament as a regular decision-making body as well. So we can point to all of that. At the same time, there were several movements that we can say, look, there were a few disruptions in order in this period. So following on from the civil war under King John surrounding Magna Carta, and after the re-establishment of King John's dynasty with Henry III in the early 13th century, there's a rebellion in the early 1230s, which is basically a sort of a testing ground for Magna Carta. So this is where the king, for a short period in the early 1230s, sets about, he deprives several barons of their property without reason, without judgment. Mm-hmm. And the bishops confront the king, and several barons go into rebellion, and the king has to admit the error of his ways. So that was a rebellion, but it's important, I think, to point out that this is a really good case for showing what rebellion can be and what rebellion is. Rebellion in this period, in the 12th and 13th century, is really potentially a legitimate form of protest against illegal or improper royal rule. So if the king does something wrong, taking up arms in rebellion, as long as you do it properly and according to the rules, can actually be a legitimate form of protest. And the rebellion of the early 1230s is a case in point. The king was behaving illegally. He was breaking the terms of Magna Carta. A rebellion serves to call him to account in conjunction with the action of bishops who say, look, we're the enforcers of Magna Carta by sentence of excommunication, and they work in concert with the rebellious barons. So rebellion can look like instability, but actually it can, if done within the boundaries of what was acceptable, it can be a way of restoring proper government. It wasn't necessarily seen as treasonous or anything like that, as we might think of it in the 14th or 15th century.
It can, in fact, be the constructive means to an end if there is no alternative. And unlike today, where we do have that really well-defined infrastructure for policy making, if we give it the modern day term, policy making through, I mean, today we'd have green papers, then white papers, people would take advice, and there would be a conclusion set against potential consequences. 800 years ago, is that right? My maths right?
Yes. 800 years
ago, that infrastructure didn't exist. So all you could do was sit with the king, taking wise counsel, immediate consequences, then cascading down, and rebellion being the only way to say, do you know what? You might not have got that right.
Precisely. And this is the key question. It's Look, if you imagine a society where monarchy is the form of government, and there's no notion of changing that until we get to the 1250s, 1260s, which is another issue. What do you do as a subject if your government is going awry, if your government is overstepping the bounds of lawful government, there's a policy you don't agree with, or what happens if there's a series of policies you don't agree with? What can you do to call your government to account? And this is the big question. So Magna Carta was one potential way, but then it's how does one enforce it? Rebellion is a very, very important way of calling the government to account. Excommunication by the bishops becomes a really important way of calling the king to account as well. The question then becomes, as we move into the late 1250s and into the 1260s, what happens if that's just not quite enough? And this is one of the tricky questions. You can see when you get someone like King John, who is, I think we can all agree now, a pretty nasty piece of work, or we get the kind of actions that Henry III pursues in the early 1230s, which are palpably illegal. It's obvious that the king is governing illegally beyond the law. And you can see there's a really clear case there for rebellion or potentially excommunication. But what happens if you get a king or a government that isn't tyrannical as such, but just isn't very good? Yeah. What happens when you get a situation with Henry III where he makes various mistakes? Perhaps you don't agree with his sort of policies on patronage. He makes a mistake in signing up to a very expensive foreign campaign in the Mediterranean. He has an idea of sort of conquering Sicily, but could never afford really to do it. And apart from this, he's the sort of king where there are various grievances that people have with his rule, but you couldn't necessarily say it was bad enough to go into rebellion. But at the same time, you can see things going wrong. What exactly do you do?
Yeah, what is your first recourse to action? And how can it be effective if the only thing you can do is run the risk of actually causing rebellion, physical rebellion? It's not just dissent, we don't like this, it's actual, no, we are going to take up arms. So let's take this a step back towards Simon, because if the king is the policymaker, and if things aren't necessarily going to plan for each tier of society, let's think about Simon's role in this and the reputation perhaps that he's developing as, I don't know if an alternative is the way to pitch him, or as the potential voice for dissent. How does he get to that point where people are starting to say, do you know what, Simon might have an idea about what's going on?
Well, he really makes his reputation internationally in the 1240s and 1250s.
Wow.
So we've said he was sort of brought up with this idea of being a great crusader. Yep. He goes on crusade in 1240, 1241, on an expedition known as the Baron's Crusade to Syria and Egypt. And we don't quite know what he got up to there. Our sources are just very patchy. But by the end of that expedition, he was being put forward by the barons of the Kingdom of Jerusalem as a candidate to be regent of the Kingdom of Jerusalem whilst their king was underage.
Whoa.
So they saw him as, the, you know, this is Simon de Montfort, early 30s, in 1240, 1241, being put forward as somebody who could run a kingdom.
Now I'm going to interject here, because what I find fascinating is the spiral of, not evolution, but the spiral of attainment, accrual and achievement through exploration. Because as people are starting to crusade, to travel, as they have the ability, and I know we don't like using the word technology, but that's what it is, as they have developed technologies, however simple, to afford them travel and exploration, they are also bringing back cultural insights that are starting to inform the art of the possible societally back in Britain, aren't they? So Simon's reputation internationally, does he have the same kind of esteem here at home? Is he still a leader here, potential leader?
Yes. So firstly, home in the sense of France, in the sense of England and France being very, very close at this time. So he's also put forward in the early 1250s as a candidate for the regency in France when the king is off on crusade. So similarly, the barons of the Kingdom of France see him as somebody who could lead them, who could run the kingdom. And also in the same period in the early 1250s, he is set up by his king, Henry III, as governor of Gascony. The kings of England ruled over Gascony in southwestern France in the Middle Ages. It needed a governor. The king chose Simon. So he's been sent to Gascony with quasi-regal powers to govern that region. It all goes wrong in the end in Gascony. He falls out with the Gascons. There's an inquiry held. And it's a big source of rupture between Simon and Henry III that he sort of put in front of this inquiry.
Okay. So that's where it comes from.
Yes, it's one of the big causes of upset between them. But partly because this inquiry was a bad precedent to set in terms of, the king's magnates being put in front of this kind of procedure. Various of the English earls step forward and say to the king, "You can't do this. You can't subject him to this sort of inquiry and procedure for pursuing a government that you set him up to run." So he's certainly, I say he's popular, or he's seen as a leading magnate in England, but he is, if you think of the government of Gascony as being, again, setting up almost to run a region like he's a king, Gascony, the Kingdom of France and the Kingdom of Jerusalem, these are three invitations across Christendom for him to act in running a territory.
Wow. So let's focus on Simon for a moment. The king does not enjoy scrutiny. So what is it that actually tips Simon over the edge and says, "Do you know what? You're not listening to good advice now. I've got to do something about it."
It's a tricky one, because if we stand back and look, it doesn't necessarily look any worse than it had done in previous years. We've got to ask, why now? Why in 1258? Yeah. This all kicks off in 1258.
What was the trigger?
Yeah, it kicks off in a parliament in 1258, and we can point to a few triggers. So one of those is the king's patronage of his half-brothers. There was a limited amount of land and resources to go around in the patronage pot, and some people were irked that the king was giving it to some rather than others. So there was partly an issue as well that these half-brothers, who were the children of Isabella of Angoulême, Henry III's mother by her second marriage, who'd come and set up their homes in England. There was an issue that they'd fallen out with various of the English barons and were pursuing their feuds by violence, which was not okay. You pursue a feud by law, by legal recourse, not by violence. And Henry III really wasn't interested in providing justice to sort this stuff out. He just sort of wanted everyone to be friends, I think. So there was that. Can't we just all be friends? And let's just forget about it. Let's just get on with things. And of course, that's just not okay. If somebody attacks your lands and kills your men, you want legal recourse. You don't want the king to just tell you to put it to one side. There was also this idea that Henry III had to go off and conquer Sicily on behalf of his younger son, which was going to cost an eye-watering amount of money, and he hadn't sought council or consent of Parliament before he signed up to it. So all of these things were bubbling away and causing a lot of discontent at court. At the same time, if we put that in the long-term perspective, was it really any worse than what was going on under King John, say? Well, it wasn't. But at the same time, I think what we can see happening in 1258 in this parliament is a sort of an atmosphere. It's an atmosphere of vexation that sort of bubbles into almost a violent fury, where you've got Simon de Montfort and various other magnates on one side, and then you've got the king's half-brothers on the other. They almost breaks into a fist fight in Parliament, and the king has to break it up. And what happens is that Simon de Montfort and the Earl of Gloucester and various other barons gang together in a back room somewhere, and they all swear an oath to support each other against these vexations, and to defend each other come what may. And you can see them, you can just sort of imagine them egging each other on to do this until it all boils over one morning when they march on the King's Hall at Westminster and demand that he hand over the reins of government to them so that they can set up a council to run the kingdom. There'll be no taxation or anything without, unless it goes through Parliament, but also the key officers of state, like the Chancellor, the Chief Justice, the Treasurer, these will all be set up by the council. So this council will control the machinery of government and also the king's castles and all his possessions. So it has this council of barons, and then barons and bishops will really take control of the running of the country for the foreseeable future. And this is something entirely new. It's not a rebellion. We've said rebellion could be a sort of legitimate form of armed protest to call the king to account. This first of all takes place pretty much secretly in Westminster in 1258. The wider population doesn't know what's going on deliberately because it's so shocking. The idea that you can seize power from an anointed monarch and actually change the way that the country is run.
And that's really important, because at this point in time, we've still got this idea of almost the hand of God, the deification of monarchy, as in it's the king, what the king says goes. We've just gone through a period where Magna Carta is starting to become not just a concept, but it's a reality, this idea of structure and what a king may or may not do. And so I guess the idea of not removing a king, but actually inhibiting his God-given ability to rule is quite, I mean, it's more than divisive. So if it's a backroom coup, rebellion, insert word of choice here, what actually happens physically to Henry then? Does Simon, they don't sort of bundle him up and put him in a blanket box, do they?
Not at this stage. Not at this stage. So he is somehow coerced or cajoled into giving an oath to support this regime by some kind of mixture of pressure, the threat of force, and the promise of, you know, the council's going to look after things for now, and we're going to sort stuff out. So he's forced to give this oath. Now, you can't, this is one of the big issues as well, and the Pope would go on to annul this oath, because you can't hold a gun to someone's head and promise them to stake their soul. It's not legal. So that's one of the ways that they keep him under control. They take control, as I said, of the machinery of government, so that all letters and orders are issued in the king's name, in his voice, but only by the council, because they have, you know, the seal and the ability to issue these orders. They can control communication, so they can stop Henry, for instance, sending out for help to the King of France or to the Pope.
This is what his rule.
Sorry?
They can censor his rule.
Exactly. So that they can control communication to the wider populace, and they can control Henry's personal communication. Things break down in the early 1260s because Henry was able to get word to the King of France and to the Pope to tell them what had been going on. And as soon as the Pope heard, you know, said, this is not okay, I'm stepping in to annul this. So this is how it was done in 1258, 1259, whilst the council put in place a whole series of reforms for the government of the kingdom. Henry overthrew this system by getting word to the Pope in the early 1260s. And then the only way after that to reimpose this system of council and these reforming measures in the 1260s, in 1263, 1264, was by open war.
Okay, so we're talking again about the international, transcontinental, if you like, influence of religion. Always an influence at this point. It's not just, I'm absolutely fascinated by the idea now that in the middle of all this, we've got a really solid, tight form of parliamentary governance emerging that is being set down, it's being audited, it's being monitored, and that is starting to have that cascade effect through society. It's no longer just serfs in the fields going, oh, there's a god, there's a king, there's a pope, we've got these different religions. There's law and order in society. So with that in mind, this idea of structure, what does Simon put in place if he's usurped the king's position? What kind of governance does he want to put in place instead?
We can very much say that in 1258, 1259, when Simon and his confederates take power, they had a vision for what they wanted to put in place. So they might have been acting almost on the spur of the moment when they seized power, but they had a very clear idea of what they wanted to achieve. So once they've taken control of government, and this comes, they put in place this whole series of reforms that come under the banner of the Provisions of Oxford, issued in, over 1258 and 1259. And one of the key tenets of that was providing justice to the wider population.
Wow.
So the idea here was that Henry III was governing under Magna Carta. But if we sort of row back to the early 13th century and the beginnings of Magna Carta is largely concerned with the betterment of the barons and the king. It doesn't have a huge amount to say about what should be done for the wider population, the sort of ordinary women and men on the street or in the field. And it very much provides the mechanisms for the barons to keep their tenants under their own heels as much as the king. What we see in the 1258-1259 period is Simon de Montfort and his confederates saying, that's not okay anymore. It might not be that we are legally obliged to give the peasantry a better deal, but we are morally and spiritually obliged to look after their interests.
Yeah.
So whereas, and I think it's important to note here as well, that one of the issues with Magna Carta that was identified in the 1250s, 1260s, was that it set a legal boundary on how the king could treat his barons, his great men, but it didn't really set any boundary apart from sort of the headline clauses about justice on how he could treat his treat the general peasantry. And that meant that when Henry III needed money, he could go to Parliament and ask his barons and bishops. They could just tell him no. Go away in non too polite terms, which is what they often did. How does he get his money? He does it by extorting money from the peasantry, through his sheriffs, through his judges, through a fairly oppressive system of local government. So when Simon de Montfort et al. Seized power in 1258, they put this aside. They put in place various legal reforms that kind of seek to weed out corruption again, amongst royal officers, and to put a stopper on this kind of financial exploitation. But they also set up a new chief justice who will travel the kingdom and hear the complaints of the wider population. And importantly, this involved a new measure where ordinary men and women could just sort of come and make their complaint. They wouldn't have to get a legal document to initiate a case or anything like that. They could just sort of roll up and make a verbal complaint, and it would be investigated. And this brought to light all sorts of sort of corrupt practices amongst, you know, sort of sheriffs and bailiffs and so on. So it gave people access to justice, and there was very much a kind of a moral and spiritual impetus behind this that came, I think, very much from Simon de Montfort and his kind of circle of friends amongst the bishops and the Franciscan and Dominican friars. It was a bit tricky because this was an incredibly ambitious project, and it was just basically, it was a bit too much. It just couldn't achieve what it wanted to because of the weight of business it was asked to take on. But this was very much a key part of the reforming enterprise.
I find this fascinating because if we st- stepped back for just a moment and said, completely out of context, by the way, there's a governing infrastructure that involves local government and local representation. You can go along to your parish council and make a local complaint. It's not so different from actually what we have today. So is this Simon's legacy, that this infrastructure ended up being the framework, the basis from which we today have our, what we think of as government?
Well, I think there's a couple of key legacies, and one of them very much is that ability for ordinary people to bring complaints directly to government, whether that's through a local representative or whether that's through a travelling justice or to parliament. So it wasn't until Edward I's reign in the later 13th century that we see this new system of petitions to parliament really established. Well, that's where, you know, communities can actually put forward written grievances and complaints and so on. But this idea was very much at the heart of the Montfortian enterprise through that itinerant justice and through the importance of parliament. So I think that's a very important legacy. Basically, once you've told the wider population that they're entitled to bring their complaints to the king directly, that's what people expect. Exactly. You just kind of raise the expectations of government. So that's an important point. The other important point is holding parliament as a regular part of the government of the kingdom. So not just sporadically when the king wants a parliament, but as an ordinary point of business. So in 1258, one of the key reforming measures was that parliament should be held three times a year, come what may. Now, that didn't necessarily stick afterwards, but Parliament from that point forwards had to be held, particularly when the king wanted tax and he had to consult. And what was particularly important about the Parliament of the early months of 1265, which was one of these parliaments that had to be held three times a year, was that, yes, it was representatives from the towns as well as knights from the shires, which was one of the legacies, but also holding government just to have discussion about policy, not just because it's a tax. So again, once you start telling townspeople as well as knights, as well as the great magnates and bishops, that they're entitled to have a say in discussion, that raises expectations.
It's phenomenal. So I feel like we've only barely started exploring not just Simon himself, but Simon's legacy. And I know that in your book, if I look at the introductions to your book, you describe him as heir to a great warrior, devoted husband and father, fearless crusader knight and charismatic leader. I was particularly struck by, and I think it might even be your first sentence, it was around 8:30 in the morning, with summer rain clouds weighing heavy in the sky, that Simon de Montfort decided to die. I think that is possibly the best place to leave this, because what I hope people will do is obviously grab a copy of your book, discover Simon for themselves, and perhaps explore. I mean, I've had my eyes open today in terms of how Simon's legacy has shaped how we are governed now. I just want to say thank you, because it's been a real eye-opener to somebody whose name I knew, but I didn't know much about him. Sophie, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. What else are you working on at the moment? Please tell us you're doing another book.
I am doing another book. I'm working particularly now on what we might call sort of social military history. So I'm interested in the later Middle Ages, about the experience of people of lower status, so not so much the great bishops and barons that I've been looking at particularly in with Simon de Montfort, but the guys on the ground and what war and what battle was like for them in the later Middle Ages. So that's what I'm working on now for my next book.
That's brilliant. Would you like to come back and perhaps tell us about some of the sources you're using for that? Because I imagine that's fascinating.
I'd love to. I'm only just beginning that project, and it's a really big process of exploration, because you have to sort of cast the net wide and look for a whole wide range of sources to kind of pick out these stories. So it'll be a little while yet, but I'd love to. Thank you.
That'd be great. Sophie, thank you very much indeed. That's been fantastic.
Thanks very much, Mervyn. Thanks for having me.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great